Welcome to the Movement Podcast. This show is all about movement.
We tackle it from different angles, bring on guests, answer questions, go on a few tangents, and give practical advice.
Giving you a better idea of how you can optimize the human body to be the best it can be. Let's preview what's coming up in this episode.
Worldwide, what's the leading cause of disability? If you said low back pain, you'd be correct. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Kyle Kiesel. Kyle's an expert in low back pain and professor emeritus and former chair of the physical therapy department at the University of Evansville. On this episode, we cover pros and cons of pain as a diagnosis, risk factors, and options for early intervention, management, and even prevention. So let's get going with this episode of the Movement Podcast, powered by FMS. So, Gray, pretty awesome to have one of the oldest members of the FMS family, not literally oldest, but figuratively, I guess, Dr. Kyle Kiesel, talking about a topic that I would argue he's one of the foremost experts, maybe even around the world, on low back pain. He always talks about, you know, FMS and SFMA, but, you know, Kyle, you've been in the really studying back pain for quite a few years now. So when you hear the word low back pain, what's your first thoughts when you start trying to get? I'm sure that when you're sitting around having your bourbon and one of your friends come over, they're going to be asking you a bunch of questions about low back pain, right?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks. Just let me say thanks for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts. I've been dealing with back pain both personally and from a research perspective for a number of years. You know, when Gray and I were working in the clinic back in the day, we started looking at deep muscle function. And about that time, Paul Hodges and his group in Australia started looking at it as well. And they were taking a research perspective and we were taking a clinical perspective. And as I evolved into my dissertation work and my research, I went with back pain to try to figure out how to do measurement and learn more about deep muscle function. So I have really fond memories of being in the middle of low back pain, thinking about it from a local perspective, a deep muscle perspective, and holding on to my roots as a movement expert. And so I always said that I felt like I had Paul Hodges on one shoulder and Gray Cook on the other as I was sort of working and putting my dissertation work together. So some good memories for me as I've go back and think through that and look at what we can do to manage back pain going forward.
I think what you did is you took as deep a dive in one aspect as the other, the global signature of what low back dysfunction and pain looks like, and then many of the local contributors or complicating factors. And so many people pick one side of the fence to live on and try to fix it all from this global perspective or try to appreciate function from a local perspective. And, you know, if structure and function are supposed to be both sides of the argument, measurement tools on each side are there. And the funny thing that goes back to me is it didn't take me long in my manual therapy background, no matter what we were doing with screening or balance or functional assessment at the time, you and I were doing these little manual multifidus tests and these segmental provocations. And then, you know, when you went off to take the deep dive, there were two things going on, the global perspective, the local perspective. But there's one other thing that I want the listeners to know. And when you took up the breathing aspect, when you sort of grabbed that leg of the stool that we knew we needed to confront, everybody in exercise and rehab thinks breathing's important, yet we still didn't have screens or measurements or baselines for that. And you came back from that journey and offered us three slices of pie, almost a mechanical breathing problem, a chemical respiration problem, and then this thing that was wound up into cycles, psychosocial responses into breathing. That's the other way we look at back pain. And if you're not equally appreciating the local, the global, and then the different, you know, segments that can put you in, you're going to miss something. And that's where I think that local, global, but then put me in those three slices of pie of these behaviors, because you're going to have all three present, but which one's the bottleneck, which one's the weakest link is how we get there.
And Kyle, I'm going to back up for a second and look, kind of go and just take generally speaking, you know, because when we throw out the topic low back pain, everybody leans in, whether it's personal, whether you're a professional, whether you're a clinician as a professional, whether you're a fitness or strength conditioning professional, because either you suffer from it personally or you're dealing with somebody who's got back pain. So from your perspective, that's a huge kind of brush, right? When you say everybody's going to lean in, let's talk about back pain. I mean, how do you approach that as an expert in both what kind of you talked about global versus kind of more just more specific?
Yeah, well put. I mean, unfortunately, it's just a massive problem around the world, right? I mean, you can look at the stats. They keep really, they haven't changed much in terms of it. Back pain is the number one driver of disability and cost for healthcare perspective around the world. So, you know, I think you have to have an open mind and look toward some new ideas without going down a rabbit hole that's going to get us where we are really today, which was with overdoing diagnosis and trying to throw technology and imaging at a problem that really very rarely has a true imaging finding that we can put our hands onto or do something with. So you got to keep open. And you know, at the end of the day, the reality of it, when you look in the weeds at risk factors or just look at it from a common sense perspective, you land in the same place. It's you got to take care of yourself to a certain level. You got to cover some very fundamental things of wellness or fitness, whatever term you want to use for that. And that's your best bet in terms of preventing and managing back pain in the bigger picture.
So the first thing I hear you saying is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, because once you're in that category, it's a slippery slope whether you're going to find the right path or not. Let's go back to the ounce of prevention. If we were coming at low back pain, like I think we as a group have tried to come at the high school ACL injury in both males and females. If we had to see what that ACL looks like 6 months before it happens, what are we looking for? We're looking for poor movement patterns, poor balance, very stiff ankles, and maybe a weak core. The people who can check 3 out of 4 or 5 of those boxes are probably going to be in the ACL category more than the people that aren't checking any of those boxes. If I haven't had low back pain yet, what are some of those things that tell you within 5 years it's happening? All I got to do is keep trying to be active or participate in things I love. What do you see on the horizon for just going ahead and saying this person right now is at greater risk for maybe a low back pain episode than somebody who doesn't have these things? What are they other than pain in the back?
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's a unicorn. Somebody hasn't had back pain. So it is really honestly very challenging to study because it's hard to find a meaningful group that hasn't had an episode. But it really goes back to fundamentals. I mean, as you said, there's the psychosocial piece that has really grown in terms of treatment. And my view, I think it's pendulum swung a little too far. I mean, there's a bio piece that we can't forget about. So if I had to look to say, all right, what am I looking for someone? Let's find success. What's somebody that hasn't had a back pain episode? What are they going to look like? They're going to be pretty squared up at home, meaning that they're not going to have major psychosocial components to them. They're going to be happy at their workplace and like their boss. And they're going to have a pretty good BMI. And I guarantee you, they're not going to have, you know, if you look at our tools, there's going to be no zeros and no ones on the FMS. I'm very confident in that. If you want to say it another way, they're going to have some fundamental movement patterns that they just naturally own. You know, they're not borrowing them. They're not working on them at the gym. They sort of roll over, jump out of bed and touch their toes kind of thing. That's hard. You know, I think, you know, you always go back in time and think about things from an evolutionary perspective. And I love the way you guys do that. But if you think about back in the days when we're hunting and gathering, I mean, we're moving around, we're doing things, we're lifting, our core's engaged, we're not overweight. You know, we're challenging ourselves, breathing and then relaxing and resting. And so you go through these cycles of stress and recovery that I think flush the system. And you know, today's society, we just don't get any of that. So.
Yeah. I think that's, a clean perspective to look at. And I think we're all looking looking for ways to probably manage our lives better. I know right up until I was 40, I was more concerned with performance. After 40, I was more concerned with independence. I don't want to need a lot of people to do the things I want to do physically. And every time I do have to slow down or recover from a surgery or something like that, it drastically infringes on my freedom to do some of the things I want to do. And I don't have to do them at a high performance level. I don't have to win paddleboard races, but I got a paddleboard, you know, so it becomes the switch flips. And with that expectation needs to be a lot more proactivity than reactivity. And so, you know, I think we can all listen to what Kyle just said. If your relationships are on fire, if your movement patterns aren't authentic, if your balance is below the cut, and if your BMI is higher than it should be, you're going to get another little surprise pretty soon.
Well, that therein lies the problem, right, Kyle, is how many people check all those boxes and can say that, right? I mean, that's the problem. And then people are just grasping at straws on, and I think that's really what we can, you know, maybe segue into. Okay, how do we go about this problem? The solution ultimately is to prevent. What to prevent is to, let's just be honest, be healthy. I mean, generally be pretty healthy and be stress-free, and you're probably less likely to have back pain. Well, we already know most of the population out there is not. So, you know, so that leads us to this person walking around who's got some back pain, and then they're going to seek out a physician. They're going to seek out a therapist. They're going to seek out a physical or a trainer to help them with their low back pain. And the trainer's left with, or the physical therapist left with, oh, let's just do bird dogs or get your, you know, get your core engaged. So let's kind of dive into what do we do with the current situation?
Yeah, a lot to unpack there. I think let's just start with the wellness idea. You know, we've been talking about that a lot. It's I don't think the recipe is that hard to figure out from a research perspective or a professional perspective, but coming up with tools that can help an individual figure out what their biggest problem in all the wellness constructs or all the dimensions of wellness, where's your biggest problem individually? That's a challenge. And that's things that we need to be working on, because let's face it, you know, there's apps for everything today, and you can't just have 10 apps for each of the 10 dimensions of wellness if you think about it that way. So first, I think you have to figure out with some help what's the biggest thing you need to be working on. You know, maybe it is behavioral oriented things. Maybe it is fear, but maybe it's an ankle or a core. So I think from a perspective first, cover the minimums in wellness. And at the end of the day, you say, Lee, I mean, we're talking about behavioral change and it's kind of a holy grail to find behavioral change tools that work. And so we're going to keep chipping away. We're not going to throw in the towel and just say it's too hard. But from a wellness perspective, I think that's number one. You know, then we move into treatment. You know, my back hurts and it's continuing to hurt. What can we do? And what have we learned over the years? That's a whole lot of things to consider. You know, I think we've gone from, in the rehab world, we've gone from looking at it from a person's perspective, a dogma, if you will, of one way to treat it, to this research way to look at everything, swung all the way over to the psychosocial part and pain science and education, and really over there, at the end of the day, that slice of pie that Gray mentioned isn't that big. I think it's not the biggest problem for most people with back pain. And so now we come right back to the middle. Well, what are we going to do? And I think really if you stack up the evidence, some good education matters in terms of how your brain interprets pain. I think it's important to recognize very simply that nociception, or what goes on in the periphery, the little signal that gets that sends the message to your brain that something is in danger in your body, and the experience of pain are two different things. I think if we just educate people on that, we're in pretty good shape. And then it's just get right down and fix major mobility issues and get them on a progression for core retraining. There's just no doubt about that. When we say core, we're talking about fundamental breathing and rolling patterns that have to be absolutely owned, and then work our way up, quadruped work, kneeling work. And then to me, ultimately, that single leg deadlift is probably your number one way to stay out of back pain over time if you can do it appropriately. So I know that's a lot, but it's a balance of those things. And if you just pick one of them, you're probably going to be missing things a little bit for most people.
No, I think you nailed that very well. And I arrived at that single leg deadlift as a bottom up demonstration of core stability. Pavel Setsulin with Strong First asked me one time, "How do you evaluate the back?" And I'm like, you know, I look for basic limitations in mobility in the back, and outside of that, I let the hips and shoulders tell me a whole lot. And I think what you just said there, I want to unpack a little bit for the listeners, because the spine is obligated to compensate when the extremities cannot do their job efficiently. So a lack of shoulder mobility, hip mobility, ankle mobility, foot stability, knee stability, you know, your spine will immediately accommodate the situation, because in your developmental sequence, part of your locomotion required a lot of spine movement that doesn't look like gait at all. When you're quadruped and rolling, your spine is actually part of your locomotion. And when you're upright, your spine is actually more of a transfer of forces. And so your spine eloquently in the developmental sequence goes through this natural responsibility of, I've got to use my mobility. Now I've got to conserve my mobility and use my stability. And so when you said you got to lead with mobility, I don't think people really understand you cannot regain appropriate posture and motor control responses of your spine to postures and patterns if you miss something in an extremity, because the compensation algorithm is already written. It's for survival. And secondly, when the person does have that episode of low back pain, the allopathic medical model will ask for imaging. You said imaging doesn't really even tell us anything meaningful about our next action point, because our next action point in low back pain is going to have a lot more to do with certain behaviors, your movement, balancing, or lifestyle behaviors, your breathing behaviors, you know, your asymmetrical behaviors will have a lot more impact. So we're still getting imaging. The allopathic model is going to do an x-ray, and if it looks bad enough, you get your MRI, or if you don't do well in 2 weeks in therapy, you get an MRI. Has a 40-year-old on the planet ever had a low back x-ray and said completely normal findings? The radiologist is obliged to say degenerative joint disease, degenerative disc disease, and most 40-year-old backs are going to show some of that. But that necessarily isn't the cause, no more than it is when they take an x-ray of my right knee and see degeneration and want to replace it. My left knee is equally degenerated but asymptomatic, and nobody's replacing that. So it's almost like they use the structure to make a structural call, but then when the structure doesn't explain, they just don't know what to do. And my whole point is the measuring stick for structure and function ought to be equally heavy. And if you're light on functional measures, you're going to miss it every time, all the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty easy to beat up imaging in the spine. I mean, we've been doing that for years, and rightfully so. But when you get with good physicians that are working with this from a medical perspective, you know, they're doing their best. You know, they would say the functional measure is the rehabilitation. And when people fail rehabilitation, they land back in their office. And so they're left to keep moving down their algorithms.
So we can't blame physicians. We can't blame physicians for not asking for functional measures if we've never offered them or explained how the two work together to help us close a case.
Yeah. And I think, you know, good ones rely on therapy, and they're like, find good therapy. You know, I train physicians about back pain around the United States or around the world, literally now. And one of the biggest questions I get is, how do I find a good therapist? I mean, I hear that all the time. So, you know, I think it's easier to beat up the medical model. You know, most medical providers are trying to provide, they're doing the best they can. And, you know, the MRI question, it's kind of interesting. I was on a panel one time, so years ago, and the question of MRI was the big thing. We got to quit doing imaging, get it off. It got off of all the guidelines and it moved away. And at the end of the day, the general practice physician was sitting there going, hey, people land back in my office after they go through everything 12 months down the road, and guess what they want? They want an MRI. It's just reality. And it's peace of mind for a lot of people as well. So I don't think we're going to crack that nut. I mean, I don't. I think it's just part of how we practice. One of the best terms I heard from one of the best physicians I've worked with, in terms of really advanced back care when they are failing therapy, or we need to work together. Maybe I need an injection or I need some medicine to help this along. It's like, he goes, I spend my day explaining away MRI findings. You know, to your point, Gray, we have all this laundry list of pathoanatomical findings. Sometimes they matter, but most of the time they don't attribute directly to the problem. So it is bigger than that.
Let me just put maybe one comment here. So Kyle, my simple view, kind of going back to what you said, when we start trying to figure out how to actually approach this, one of the problems is just the term low back pain, because that really is just, it's almost like such a general term now. It doesn't, all it does is say you got pain in your back. I think what I heard you say, and I think the direction you seem to be trying to really take the profession in general is, okay, if you got low back pain, what's the problem? Where do we need to focus? And I think that's where, especially if so many people, I just came from a conference where I asked the question, how many of you personal trainers are dealing with low back pain? Every one of them raised their hand. Yeah. Is their clients are coming in with low back pain. So yeah. What are they there to do? And I think what you're talking about is, one, it's not a diagnosis, but it's a general enough term that you still don't know what's going on, but still try to kind of peel back the layers to figure out, you know, where do you start? And I think that's what you hit on quite well.
Yeah, I mean, it is debilitating, whether it's a diagnosis or not. It slows people down. It affects everything you do in the day. You roll out of bed hoping, you know, you feel good enough to do some things. I mean, if you think about how back pain affects general wellness and health, it's really hard to eat clean and exercise when your back hurts. So it's kind of a chicken and egg thing at the point where once you have it, what do we do? And I think, you know, finding good rehabilitation services is a crucial thing. I think, you know, we use this duration of symptoms at 4 weeks. When it goes into the fifth week, it's suddenly now subacute. And when it hits the 12th month, it's suddenly now chronic. Again, duration of symptoms isn't really a diagnosis, although we use it that way. And my money's on the fundamental movements and that breathing as a starting place for most people. And then as you start feeling better, start cleaning up the other pieces and figure out how to do that. But imagine, you know, your back hurts, you're a little overweight, you're carrying some high blood pressure, and really everyone, the world's telling you, hey, idiot, get off the couch, eat right and exercise. I mean, I hear it all the time. One of the last things physicians will say, eat right and exercise. It's like, well, wow, like, we've proven that we need professional help to do that appropriately as a population. It's really hard to just wake up and go eat right and start exercising. I mean, we've talked about that, I think, in our world a lot. So there's a lot to it, but it does. At the end of the day, it's going to come back to getting the right rehabilitation services, getting that professional help, clearing the fundamental mobility, and owning that neurodevelopmental posture so that you can get active and protect yourself down the road.
No, and I think that at first glance, you can see how this has grown out of proportion. I think, what is it, 25% of U.S. adults report having low back pain in the last 3 months. It's the most common pain reported. I used to think headache was, but I think back past it at some point in the last two decades. But literally having an insurance code for a self-reported symptom seems grossly irresponsible, but you're also looking at low back pain as a slow pandemic that's only getting slightly worse. And so if we handled the low back pain diagnosis, and you and I have worked with an orthopedic physician a long time ago who would have easily just said low back pain or lumbar strain, sprain, or whatever. He expected us to figure out the functional path, and he had no problem prescribing pain management medication as long as they were on the functional path, because it was there to make it more comfortable. So I can argue both sides. Having a symptom self-reported based diagnosis that you can receive pain management for sounds largely irresponsible, but it doesn't stop the pain from going away. What happens is, yes, we want to make you more comfortable. We want you to sleep better. And you and I remember early in our career on a physical exam, I don't know why, but I guess I was mimicking what I heard Paul Hughes say, who was mentoring me. He would always check with these back and neck patients. How are you sleeping? 50% of the time in a recliner, poorly, you know? And it's like, we can't win. There's nothing I can do here in the next half hour that will combat 8 hours of poor sleep and poor positioning. So getting them rest, getting them comfortable, and then going back to some of those provocations within the lifestyle. So I actually don't mind the temporary diagnosis of low back pain. I do very much have a big problem with somebody who's being medicated for low back pain and still doesn't have an accurate diagnosis at the end of 4 weeks. That seems like somebody's dropping the ball. And really, I don't even think insurance wants somebody to carry that diagnosis without some hard signs. We don't get to think we got diabetes and get insulin dispensed. We have to have the signs that are associated with those, you know, insulin type problems. We don't just get insulin because we think we're diabetic. But if we think we got a disc, we can get medication long before that has to be proved. So,
yeah, that's a good way to say it. You know, I think it's just challenging when we look at let's get away from the movement piece, because that's obviously how we approach things. But if you think about just back pain and what could be underlying causing the back pain, MRI shows some findings, but it's not lining up with their symptoms. Then we start thinking about core muscles, and we think about the core. Well, unfortunately, there's just not a good way to measure core function. I mean, that was my dissertation, whatever, 20 years ago. And still today, we don't have one definitive clinical measure for one of the most important muscles in the back, that multifidus muscle, right? So it is challenging, and that's why you do need to have multiple skills and multiple layers to put this puzzle together. It's not like, I would say this, you know, I train physicians about muscles and back pain. That's kind of what I do a lot of my time now. And I start out by saying something along the lines of, you know, if these core muscles in your back that function and create stability and do their proprioceptive role, we're like the quadricep. We could just stick a dynamometer on it and measure it. It'd be easy. If it were a bicep, it would be easy. It's not. The core is complicated. There's a lot of layers to it. Let's unpeel a few of those layers so you get a little understanding of the complication and the challenges with it. So, you know, we've identified segmental instability. The multifidus muscle's not working. It atrophies and changes, and it doesn't allow one segment to work appropriately. And we're gaining some traction with that as a diagnosis, if you will, for this non-specific chronic low back pain. And I think it's a good start as a window in to the medical world to say, okay, muscles are the problem. Let's talk about muscles. And then we're going to start talking about movement. And then we're going to start talking about risk. And we're going to start laying it on, layering that as we go. But at least we're in the conversation from a medical perspective in terms of muscle function as ultimately the problem, whether the pain generators, the facet, the disc, the ligament, the end plate, who knows? Muscles are the problem. So we're getting there from at least in the medical world.
No, I think muscle function at that segmental level is an unbelievable signature of dysfunction. And I think you helped open my eyes to, without doing something very strategic and specific, these don't spontaneously just ask to be back in the band. They just quit playing. You know, yeah. They figured out, you don't need my instrument anymore. I'm just going to go along for the ride. Where I'd like to take the logic to every person here, whether they're a clinician or not, is you being an expert in back, say they're very, very poor test for really trying to say if your core weakness is driving this or not. But I would like to argue with almost everybody out there, balance problems or movement problems that are bad enough make your core compensate whether it were previous broken or not. So if you can look at somebody who's having back dysfunction and find 2 to 3, 4 reasonable ways they would have to compensate for a gait asymmetry, ankle mobility, T-spine, posture, whatever. If you see, these are easy to measure, they're mobility. If you've got a BS degree in exercise science, you can do almost every mobility measure it would take to prove that mobility is a factor. And even if you are to offer up core strengthening exercises, if you don't remove the reason for compensation, you're gonna be sweeping the tide back with a broom. It's not gonna work. And so that was my original hypothesis. If we can remove the obvious mobility problems that cause the core to compensate and then feed the core the same diet that it ate to get to be the upright core in the first place, maybe 80-20, I'll be satisfied with that. And that's how simple it is.
That's the recipe. I think the confounding factor and the wild card in all this is the idea that when there's pain, it doesn't matter, it starts somewhere. Maybe you have a true flexion rotation kind of injury or lifting injury, or you just create some back pain over time. But the way you described bringing the muscles back into the band, that is very unpredictable between people. And the idea of inhibition of the deep muscles is really what's becoming more and more prevalent in the literature. Arthrogenic inhibition, so the joint tells the muscle to shut down that's right around it, or reflex inhibition. There's central components. There's tons on this. We could spend an hour talking about all the different research perspectives, but in most people, some more than others, the deep muscle gets inhibited, and it's very selective. It's interesting. It's selective to extension type muscles. So in the low back, the deep multifidus, but your abs don't shut down the same way. Quadriceps shuts down overnight. You lose 40% of your quad in 2 weeks when you have a knee injury. Hamstrings function pretty well. So it's just an interesting phenomenon that there are some muscles that are more susceptible to inhibition. And in some people, that inhibition is so great that we just can't overcome it with the doses of manual therapy and exercising. And we have to look elsewhere to overcome that inhibition in some people. And that's where it gets to be those chronic cases. And it's a real challenge.
As we discuss low back pain on the podcast today, it makes sense to let you know that we offer a clinical low back pain online course geared towards rehabilitation-oriented healthcare providers. This course includes demonstrations of evidence-based exam items and the most effective treatment techniques to ensure the best outcomes for your patients. And for a limited time to our podcast listeners, we'd like to offer a discount. Follow the link in our show notes and use promo code LBP22 at checkout for $50 off. That's LBP22 for $50 off. Sign up today and dive deeper into understanding and treating low back pain. Now back to the show. Just define, and kind of in your own words, and we can kind of create some discussion around it, acute low back pain, chronic low back pain, and then you got this non-specific chronic low back pain. And in reading some of this, and I think you touched on it, that's what made me think about it, when you say if you bend over and you lift something, you get kind of a catch, so to speak, right? And that may be an acute episode of back pain. Well, that can then lead to other things, right? But kind of going back, when I was looking at some of the research even said, and I think you'll probably debunk some of this, said that, okay, if you have an acute episode, if you just do nothing for a few weeks, you'll get better. Well, it's like, no shit. I mean, if you sit on your ass and do nothing for a month, you're going to get better. So kind of give us a rundown of just those kind of three buckets of low back pain.
Yeah. So historically, we use duration of symptoms, so how long you have the pain, to define it. Because again, we're reaching. No one knew. It wasn't other things. MRIs weren't working, right? So 4 weeks was acute pain. You have an episode, whether you wake up with it or you have a mechanism that actually you can attribute it to. It's acute back pain for the first 4 weeks. Some sources say 6 weeks, and there's subacute phase in the middle here, 6 to 12 weeks. And then at 12 weeks, you cross over that line and suddenly you have chronic back pain. So those were the best, I guess, we could do. And I've always questioned duration of symptoms as being a category. It really, I don't know. I've always struggled with that for all the reasons that we've talked about. And then as MRI findings were, or pathoanatomical findings were becoming, it was becoming clear that treating those wasn't solving the problem, right? So we had a degenerative disc. We would go in and operate on that disc. We would go in and fuse it, put in a new disc in or fuse it, and that wasn't working that well. As that came on, the term non-specific, add whatever you want to it, low back pain, became quite popular. So today there's a pretty good debate, depends on where you sit. You know, a non-specific back pain you know, in our hands, we would find an ankle, a hip, a breathing problem, nutrition, sleep, all those things. But that's hard to just make it one diagnosis, give it one thing. It's this syndrome or this combination of factors. So that's where the nonspecific came from. Some people are fighting it. Some people are like, hey, it's nonspecific, meaning I can't operate on it as a surgeon. So it's nonspecific back pain. Go to rehab or go somewhere else. You know, I can't help you. And to the acute back pain, just gets better on its own. You know, that's been around forever, right? I can take that back to the 1980s. Orthopedic surgeon in England presented at a conference. This was before we really had stringent research rules and things. And so, no, I'm not throwing stones here. Just it was the times. And he looked back at his practice and he said, acute back pain seems to be getting better. Retrospective chart review. And he came up with 80%. 80% of his back pain patients get better. And that's where it all, that's literally where it started. We can track it back to that. And then looking at it in a little bit more objective way, or adding kind of more epidemiology principles to it over time, essentially what we found was a lot of those patients that he was counting as getting better never came back, right? And so you don't know what's going on with them. So even as early as 1990, there's a paper that says, listen, 80% of the acute back pain patients don't get better. About a third of them get better. And the true course of an acute back pain episode is ultimately one of waxing and waning over time. That back pain is going to come and go. And it's taken up till 2018. If you look at the Lancet journals, a big series in back pain, Lancet, one of the top, I think, three journals in medicine in the world. If you read between the lines in their 2018 summary papers that are in there, you start seeing them recognize that acute back pain doesn't get better on its own, and actually it sets this stage of waxing and waning in about two-thirds. About a third of the people will wake up one morning, it's gone, and they're pretty good to go. So it's a recurrence theme, and it comes back. And then at some point, that acute episode that comes and goes stays a little longer in somebody. Their motion gets worse. Their activities go down. All the factors we talk about, their world gets more narrow would be a way to say it. They have another episode, the world gets more narrow. And all of a sudden, you know, maybe it's a 10-year process, and now they have chronic low back pain. And now we're in big trouble, because treating chronic low back pain is a real challenge. And that's where we start throwing lots of new things at it. So the true course is recurrence and waxing and waning. And as you wax and wane through back pain, it erodes at your ability to be well and to be fit. And I think that drives as much of it as anything to me.
That's well put. And so basically, on a 20-year journey of maintaining our comfort zone, we get a smaller life in exchange. And you know, sometimes we gotta confront that. I do want our listeners to hear you go a little bit deeper into, we were first going back and forth on, you know, before you really, really try to go specific on any one back segment, remove the compensations that could easily put unnecessary burden on those segments, because they're just gonna flare back up again when this unnatural compensation behavior is back in play. But at the same time, you use the word inhibition. Now, for the first part of my academic life in movement, I didn't know the difference between inhibition and weakness. If I saw a muscle that wasn't doing what I wanted to do, I was going to come up with a recipe of movements or resistance or program to force that muscle into submission and play its role. Well, that makes about as much sense as a, you know, pitcher doing external rotation to become a better pitcher. They do external rotation exercises to become a more durable pitcher, but it does not give them what they need on the mound to throw the array of pitches they throw. It just gives them more blood flow in their rotator cuff, and if that's the problem. So we're sitting here looking at cores that can be inhibited by movement or by a digestive problem. We're looking at a multifidus that can become inhibited from chronic inflammation and compensation. So, you know, it is a cautionary tale. Before you pack up a bunch of exercises that make the core work in multiple positions, we need to take it back down. And what I've always found work for me, and when you help me see the SFMA, we weren't working together anymore. You were deep into your back dissertation, and I was still doing the Gray Cook functional rebel thing. But when we arrived at using movement as both pain provocation and is it functional or not, we basically arrived at an entry point, because sometimes we wound up with the multifidus and sometimes we didn't. And you helped me understand that if you take them back down to that lowest level of developmental progression and you still can't get that muscle to behave, that's where I was really glad that I was within a few years of learning about dry needling and dropping some needles in that multifidus and then putting some stem on that multifidus and just letting that multifidus behave with a contraction and blood flow like it doesn't behave when you walk anymore. And that jump started a few people. And here's what, I had people that couldn't roll. And I did this little thing on their back, stimulated their multifidus for a half hour, and then they could roll. Sometimes it actually changed their single leg stance. Sometimes it didn't. But if you can take that, these inhibited muscles back to a place where they're no longer threatened and can demonstrate normal pattern-based function, there may be a chance. If you can't, I think they're inhibited and you're going to need an expert on the job.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. I mean, these new techniques or these techniques you're talking about, they're right on the money. If you try to facilitate a muscle that's inhibited in the presence of compensation around it, you're just spinning your wheels. You know, people don't get worse, they just don't get better, right? So outer core muscles tighten up to protect and compress the spine. The deep muscle stays inhibited. The longer it stays inhibited, the more it stays inhibited. It's in this loop, right?
Right.
So you got to break that cycle. So it's not adding exercise, it's down training. We use the word down training. We got to knock out trigger points, get people breathing, fix mobility, get them rolling. And then some people just continue that inhibition. Got to drop a needle, drop a thumb, do something to get that muscle going. And even sometimes we use volitional activation at that point mm-hmm. to try to get the muscle going. And so it is... It's not strengthening. I mean, it's just not. It's a lot of down training and getting people to get back in touch with their core so that that inhibition can be removed long enough to uptake a chance at normal motor control, and the muscle can contract and tell the brain, oh, hey, I'm working again. Don't forget about me. We've got studies. There's three good studies now that show cortical mapping. This is pretty high level stuff, but the area in your brain that represents each muscle in your body can be mapped out. Chronic back pain people, their multifidus and transverse abdominis is in a different place. It actually smudges, is the word that they use, smudges together with the outer core. It all becomes one. The brain can't disassociate outer and inner core.
Wow.
And it takes training to reverse that. So we can go pretty deep on this. There's lots of efforts to do that, but sometimes there's just so much noise above the muscle, so much inhibition, all the psychosocial things we're talking about. The hack is get to the nerve or get into the muscle, get below all that, get the muscle to tell the brain things are okay. And that's an opportunity to have a disinhibition effect, if you will, or hack, whatever word you want for it.
No, that's, I like the way you put that. And there is a subconscious, this means you can't control it, level of operation between, I think, the way the inner and outer core work, the superficial abdominals, the deeper abdominals, and the multifidus. And they have a cadence and rhythm and timing and signature that you can influence with conscious thought, unless you got a lot of help and a lot of positioning and a lot of input. And getting those three different instruments, inner, outer, deep multifidus, whatever, to work together is hard for us. All I would like to say is, if strengthening is going to work with your low back pain, cranky people, it would have already worked by now. So there are some people that have a lot of success just getting a little fitness, and then their back pain seems to stay at bay if they avoid some of those very provocative activities. Other people. So if you're a personal trainer working with client, if you're a strength coach listening, working with an athlete, and the stuff that's gotten other people better isn't working for one, just assume that's not their medicine and maybe not even their diagnosis. And we've got to go out. They might have to leave this little fitness or athletic goal for 2 weeks or 2 months. But the problem is they're not going to be on it much longer anyway, looking at their trajectory of how these problems compound each other. Once a vital muscle is inhibited and no longer accessible to your conscious or subconscious control. So,
yeah, no, 100%. I mean, you know, you mentioned, let's just take walking or something aerobic in nature that creates a little endorphin release. You know, sometimes that's enough to get somebody over the hump of a back pain episode. Their core muscles are able to get back on track and coordinate. Maybe not because of the walking, probably just time. And there's one of the lucky people that don't have that big inhibitory effect and probably don't have a major mobility problem. But the endorphin release helps them get through that hard 3 or 4 weeks. And all of a sudden, walking is a treatment for back pain. Again, it's the slices of pie, which person, you know, what's your biggest problem? If you have a pretty good core, but psychosocial is your biggest issue and the endorphin release from walking is helping you, then that's the person it's going to help. Right. So again, I like the analogy of medicine. Like people have different medicines for different problems. We need different treatments for different manifestations of components of fitness that affect low back, I guess.
No. And so, you know, medicine, I mean, exercise used for a fitness or a physical development goal is what it is. And a lot of people got recipes and programs out there. The minute you're using medicine as a curative tool in rehabilitation, if you don't dose it, there's a better chance you'll do harm than good. And I've had to learn that, and we've all had to learn that. And that's a message we're clinging to right now. Exercise can work in a healthcare environment, in a rehab environment, and it can work in a sports performance environment. But the difference is when you're going for a physical goal, there are programs and recipes that are well thought out by great coaches. When you're using exercise as a medicine to fix something broken or dysfunctional or malfunctioning in you, if you don't have time for the dosage, please don't take time for the exercise. Because as we know, the same medicines that cure you can kill you misappropriately diagnosed or dosed. So that's where I really want people to take the you said single leg deadlift. I think it's a great signature of a good functioning back, but that doesn't mean single leg deadlift will cure your bad back. As a matter of fact, if you can't do a Turkish get up, I wouldn't try a single leg deadlift. And I didn't say you had to do it with a kettlebell. If you can't get up, but you also said something very good about the muscles that seem to get asymmetrically inhibited are the extensor muscles. Sounds to me like you're saying the upright muscles, meaning when your back's not functioning well, if we can spend a lot of your dosed exercise time out of what we would consider on your feet functional positions, you may have a better chance to reorganize than somebody who is insistent. You know, if I try to get to the single leg deadlift by practicing it with varied weights, I could build the compensation into that. So earn your single leg deadlift, and once you get it back, don't let it go no more. Your golf game should be good and your gait should be better for it. But if you go straight to somebody with a low back issue with a single leg deadlift, which we love as a functional exercise, dose it. And the dose may be do what it takes to get it, not let's do it with a little bitty weight, you know, that I see a lot of people doing. So a Turkish get up or a sun salutation is a perfect exploration into single leg stance, and single leg deadlift is a perfect way to stress that if you'll listen to your stress responses and then dose it accordingly.
Well, one thing both of you guys have said, and I think one thing we've been saying for 25 years since the FMS started is, and Kyle, you said it, and Gray, you just said it, is, and I don't want the takeaway, because both of you guys have said it too, go do single leg deadlifts, because both of you guys have said those are great exercises, and they are great exercises, but, and I think the big caveat here that both of you guys have also said that I want to really hit on is, it may be good for some people, may not for others. And I think one of the takeaways that I want people to really understand from this conversation is don't be frustrated with that. Just because a walking program works for one client and it doesn't for the other, that's okay. But you've got to have the confidence, whether you're a physical therapist or strength conditioning professional, to realize that and make your patient or your client aware of that. Hey, we're going to go in here and we're going to do these things, but hey, we may need to try something else. And it's that trying something else, or as we have been saying for 25 years, refer them to someone else to get some help. Try to seek out a team of people to really help this problem, because one exercise, a Turkish get-up, single leg deadlift, may or may not solve the issues. It may be psychosocial. It may be diet. It may be all these other things. All we're trying to do is figure out what's not going to work.
Yes.
And then move on to the next thing.
Let me ask you both a question. Because of the way you screen, test, and assess, how often do you try or pick the wrong exercise? Seriously, you already know after your assessment, Kyle, after your screens and tests, Lee, if this is going to be good for this person. We don't have to do a trial single leg deadlift with anybody. We already know that they're appropriate for this or not. So part of the reason that we spend a lot of time, so both of you, how often do you pick the wrong exercise and then have to upgrade or downgrade, or do you pretty much arrive in that corrective window and offer something good? I mean, seriously, how often are you right just by what you're doing up front?
Yeah, no, that's a good way to say it. You know, and you can be wrong, right? I mean, you can tap an exercise a little bit too far and have to dial it back. That's why it's professional dosing. You're not just handing them the home exercises for the multifidus or for back pain. Like that doesn't work. So you can be wrong, but then we dial it back and we build it back up. Let me just add one more thing here, and I hope people didn't hear me say a treatment for low back pain is single leg deadlift, because that is not what I said. What's important to think about is that's part of that whole goal to get to a progression. We were talking about how to prevent it from coming back, and I think if you can follow the progression, which would include, as Gray mentioned, the get up, et cetera, then getting to a single leg deadlift is just a nice goal for me to work someone toward. And remember, the FMS kind of golden rule is no deadlifting without a toe touch, right?
Yeah.
And you can't have a good toe touch without a good core. It's just the reality of it. When you look at quality, if your multifidus is out, you're not going to touch your toes in a functional manner the way we would describe it. So it all sort of self-controls, but don't get your back pain patients doing single leg deadlifts. And in fact, it's a real tricky, and ask me how I know, as we start going single leg deadlift under load, just getting the load managed appropriately in a patient coming off a back pain episode needs professional care. I flared some people up because I didn't remind them how to pick up the kettlebell. And they reach forward, flex, and rotate, and pull yank on the bell, and we're right back to square one on back pain, and that's on me, right? So it is a process, and that's what the professionalism of what we do from training through rehab is important here.
No, I think that's right, because when we're talking single leg deadlift, obviously there needs to be some deadlifting criteria in there, but I think that let's be honest, we're exploring capacity on top of established competency. What is the competency I need to even confront a deadlift or a single leg deadlift? I need appropriate single leg stance, and I need full range of motion to get to the toes. Even though your deadlift might not go there, I need a range of motion signature that says you're normal or better, and I need a balance signature that says you're normal or better. So now, if we're talking single leg deadlift, that is in my capacity box. And if you haven't established a clean toe touch or clean single leg stance, then you're in my competency box. So I'm using exercises to get you to single leg stance and toe touch. And so that's where I know a lot of people who have poor range of motion or poor balance actually think that making it a little harder and doing the single leg deadlift will somehow backward translate that competency. It doesn't. It overwrites it with compensation. Now, if you don't even have single leg deadlift and mobility to touch your toes, then we go back below single leg stance and start looking at some of the reciprocal. So I just look at it in compartments. So if we're talking single leg deadlift, I think one of the things that you did say, and you didn't say it wrong, is a great benchmark for that lumbar competency and capacity is a single leg deadlift. And the assumption is it's symmetrical and it's a little bit better than average. It'd be hard to see a lot of problems in that core unless you have structural problems or really, really unique activities imposed upon that frame. Because it's showing you a pretty robust linkage that most of us will use right there.
Well, I think that's part of what, you know, we're trying to educate people, whether it's professionals or just the individual, on is understanding, as frustrating as it is, it's frustrating for everybody, and we've got to understand that and let that be part of that education process that we give to the patients and clients we're working with. You're coming in and saying your back hurts. Well, it's not going to be a quick fix. It's going to be a long-term thing, and we have to understand that there's many different things we may be trying to help you with, and if one thing is not seeming to get you where you need to go, again, it's okay to be wrong. Just be wrong quick and don't keep trying to progress and do something to somebody that just because I saw it on the internet doesn't mean it's going to work for the person I'm dealing with right now.
We all cut our teeth in a general orthopedic clinic that had a huge sports medicine outreach situation. And back when the three of us were working closely in the clinic every day, we saw a lot of knees, hips, ankles, and shoulders. But when we did get that rare adolescent athlete that had low back pain or neck pain, that was rare. I mean, we saw it, and they were with us for a while. It's quite a bit more prevalent now, and I think we all need to be sensitive to that because we've been talking about the low back pain that comes upon you when you get a little weight around the midsection and you sit a little too much and you only pick one way to express yourself physically and barely do that enough and you're avoiding walking instead of embracing it. Oh, we get it. Like Lee said it early in the podcast, be healthy. That's probably the best vaccination you can have to being visited by a lot of chronic low back pain. But what about my 14-year-old that is basically taking Tylenol PM just so they can sleep through the night and they wake up with a stiff back? That's a whole nother thing, and it's worse than it was when we used to see it, and we saw it far more rarely than we did ankles and knees and shoulders, and now it's on the rise. The ankles and knees and shoulders aren't going down, but we figured out ways to allow kids to participate in athletics with a lot of inappropriate physical signatures that are easily recognizable. And they're going to wind up in back pain too, because as you said, it's multifactorial. It's the sum of all fears, and it's going to end up in your back or neck pretty quick.
I think if you've got we're talking about adolescence. I'll say what I learned early in my career dealing with high school athletes. If you got a high school athlete or younger athlete with back pain, they need a diagnosis. They need to see a doctor. They need to see, that's where I would say, and Kyle, to kick it over to you, where they need to get an x-ray to say, okay, what's going on?
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly what I was going to say. And we beat up imaging, but, you know, athletic folks, and as they go down in age, I'm very quick to get medical on board. We need to get x-ray and sometimes MRI or CT scanning to really see there's bony lesions that are very common that can be driving things that need, that there's good treatments for that we can treat appropriately and often conservatively as well. So understanding if they have a major scoliosis that we can find and how to manage that can be very helpful as well. So absolutely don't miss an opportunity in that perspective, because missing a bony lesion and just managing that over time can be pretty debilitating down the road for people. On the other side of it, of course, our overall fitness and athleticism in youth has eroded. I don't think there's any surprise to that. I think we all kind of would agree with that. But just like a lot of things that we do in reflex response in our society, is rather than think about how do we get physical fitness levels back up maybe where they were years ago, we just look at changing the environment. And one of the things that would just drive me crazy, I can't see the other way, was back pain's coming because the backpacks are too heavy. And if we can just take the backpacks and make them lighter, back pain will go away. Now, is there a correlation between a heavy backpack and developing back pain? Maybe, depends on the study. But is that where we want to go with society, is just lightening up the backpack? I mean, I think we've got to be a little more comprehensive and critical in our problem solving from a medical and wellness perspective.
Well, we deleted deep squatting as a shooting position in the military for the same reason. A lot of people showed up. And I mean, that 18-year-old that's not going to be allowed to carry a backpack anymore may enlist in the Marines. And all of a sudden, now you got to carry one. And we don't care if your mama says you don't. So there is a point of arguing for your weakness, and you will soon own it. And that's a slippery slope. So yeah, before we manipulate the environment anymore so we all feel more normal, we were raised in a really weird time of physical culture, when unless you have an identity as an athlete, as a CrossFitter, as a skateboarder, as a surfer or a Marine, you don't have a physical culture. America doesn't have a physical culture. You've got to join a tribe like triathletes to get a physical culture. And then all you can hope is it's a balanced culture and it's not too myopic to create problems on its own. But you know, one of the things I think we've all witnessed traveling abroad where our movement lectures have taken us is we see cultures that just move well, and it's not sets and reps. I mean, you know, we've been places where, oh my gosh, it's rare to see a car. They're all bikes here, or everybody's walking, or I don't see any large people. And I'm not talking about tall. I'm talking about people that don't fit comfortably in airplane seats anymore. We just don't see as many of those people. And so you realize how comfortable you get looking around you in America and seeing how easily we all just want to be comfortable right where we wake up, and nobody's going to challenge themselves in a physical culture unless you find a tribe that challenges you in the way you like. PE class used to do that. High school athletics used to do that, but they weren't participation trophies at the time. You had to actually do something to get recognition. So as opposed to attendance.
And you know, looking at things outside of the US, diet's another big piece of it. I mean, a lot of places in the world, you know, you're walking to the market every day to get fresh fruits, vegetables, fresh food, however you want to say it. And a diet can be a big piece of that as well. Those are all good points. I mean, it all comes back to that sort of working toward finding your biggest deficit in all the dimensions of wellness that we talk about, and work on that biggest one and go from there and try to get that activity level back up. So
we embedded in the original movement screen, three provocation tests. One was for the shoulder, because the shoulder, such a mobile joint, our little movement pattern could only ping a few of the things in the shoulder. So we added this little impingement thing. It's just yes, no, did this hurt? We laid two in for the spine, because even in those days, we didn't want to see the athlete with low back pain, because it was a complex thing. We spent a couple of weeks unraveling that problem in many cases. And sometimes we'd find structural issues and sometimes we wouldn't, but we'd find a bunch of other movement issues too. So the other two provocation tests that were embedded in the movement screen from day one were a prone press up and a posterior rock, right? And so it's basically, can your spine handle unloaded flexion, and can your spine handle at least non-vertical extension? And if either of those things hurt you, that's a trump card for your entire movement screen. That means I need to know why this is before I need to know why you can't deep squat. That's how important that was to us. Even in those days, we didn't even know why. We weren't sitting on half the knowledge that you've gained in your deep dive into low back. And yet we knew at that time, ooh, if these hurt your back, we're throwing a flag on the play. Your movement screen doesn't even matter anymore until we remove these two things through at least diagnosis and understanding. And sometimes we might have to just pull you out. But speak to just those simple provocations. And if people would take action with something as simple as that, exercise isn't even a conversation right now if you've got pain on the prone press up. I don't care. I got to figure out why this is in an otherwise healthy person.
Yeah, I mean, we could take it down a low back route, but let's go a much broader perspective here, and not to open up a whole new topic of FMS, the functional movement screen, and research, but clear in multiple studies around multiple populations, systematic reviews, et cetera, around the world. If there's pain with movement, and particularly on the movement screen, and many of those patients that or subjects that have pain, it is during the clearing test, as you described, with either extension or flexion on the spine movement. If that's positive, meaning there's pain present during that test, that is a strong predictor of future time loss injury. Someone's really going to be hurt in the next 12 months. All the movement studies, all the FMS studies, that is one thing that has clearly come through as a strong signal. So that intuition to just say, man, if your spine hurts, probably going to set up some problems for the rest of your body, actually has trickled through in the research as well. And that's not saying they're going to have back pain. It means they're going to have a time loss injury. Sometimes it's an ACL. Sometimes it's anterior knee pain. Sometimes it's neck pain, right? So I think, you know, we won't go down the whole research FMS path today, but that one certainly is a strong signal that came through.
So it would be probably an appropriate statement for people who may not have a medical background, at least on a simple movement of flexion or extension of the back in a very normal situation. I mean, kids at play get into these positions all the time. That even if you don't report back pain or pain in your activities, the signature, if we take you through a screen, because a lot of people just know their body just avoids patterns. And until they visit a very sort of democratic palette of this is all your body should be able to do, even though you may not have been doing it. So a lot of people who come to the movement screen don't say, I have low back pain or knee pain. They don't come complaining about a symptom, yet when we ask them to go through an authentic signature, the color wheel of movement, if you will, they can't do it without pain, but they didn't report pain. And to me, that's a capture point, meaning we just captured a sign before a symptom. And so much of what we do in orthopedic practice is we wait for you to hurt and we work backward. I mean, I would much rather prevent the crime than have the best CSI lab in the world. Because if you prevent the crime, it's unnecessary. And that's the whole thing. A lot of people are very surprised. And as we were with the movement screen in the early days, a 20% fail rate due to pain on the movement screen of people who'd already passed a clearing medical exam or pre-participation physical. So Kelly Starrett even said it, you set the bar pretty low with the movement screen and people are still flunking it. And that's, we got to own that. And we got to own that. And we can't cover that up anymore, because life is going to do exactly what the screen's doing to us. It just does it over time instead of this compressed little numeric thumbprint we're getting.
Yeah, no, I'm with you 100%. I mean, it's just the reality of it. And I would say, I don't know how low the movement screen bar is. I mean, if we say passing a movement screen is no zeros and no ones on the functional movement screen, and then you add in a competent balance test from the Y balance test, talking about a small percent of the population. I mean, maybe that's a low bar, but it's one that not many people are reaching, that's for sure.
Well, but so many people want to work out like a Spartan. If you'd taken the movement screen and the Y balance test to Sparta, I don't think we'd have been disappointed. They woke up with that. They added the muscle and fighting prowess. And that's the whole point. You know, we want to work out and look like Sparta, but we don't own the minimum competencies where you start building that house in the first place. And getting that foundation right is something nature handed us. And then all of a sudden we handed it right back and get on the escalator.
Well, I think a slippery slope that we're going down is kind of what you guys both are touching on. One is just how normal is pain becoming, just in general. I mean, how many people walk around just thinking that, yeah, my back hurts. That's just, I'm 40 or 50 or 60 years old. Yeah, my back hurts. That's just the way it is. Or, you know, I heard it again, at a conference I was recently at, saying, you know, my clients just aren't going to be able to do this. Do you have something easier? And it's like, they're there to work out. They're there to see you to work out. So are we getting to a point where pain is looked at as somewhat normal once you get to a certain point in your life, and you shouldn't be able to touch your toes once you get to a certain point in your life? I'm not saying that's certainly, we'd all agree, not where it needs to go, but we as professionals have to head that off before we get to a point where, yeah, you know, most people can't touch their toes, so we're not going to even test it.
I think most clients and athletes that are seeking a physical mentor, whether it be in a coach or a trainer, are looking for a challenge. And I can challenge a lot of people without putting you on your feet. I've challenged NFL players in a half Turkish getup, and I've challenged a lot of high-end athletes with something as simple as rolling. So I honestly think if we bring the challenge, right, it doesn't matter what it looks like. It doesn't have to be at the end of a battling rope or with chalk on your hands. I've taken triathletes and put them in half kneeling on one side, put them in half kneeling on the other side. They smoke out. This is somebody who can run a marathon and ride a bike 100 miles, and they turn around and smoke out in a developmental position. What I've created is this understanding that you came here for a challenge. I found your weakest link. Let's do this. And I honestly think if people would just package that challenge, it's not a remedial exercise. It's exactly what you need. This is as steep on-ramp to fitness as you can have, and I'll own it with you, and I'll own it for you, and I'll show you a few tests that get better by doing this. That's the confidence level in doing it. So I honestly think that good coaches and trainers simply need to meet you where you are and create a challenging and probably entertaining or at least ethos in that environment. We can do that. That's not hard.
Well, I think part of what we have to do as professionals, and I think we have been saying it a lot over the last few years, is we have to create that awareness in the individual that that's not normal, and let them know that that's something you can get better. It's not normal for you to have back pain. It's not normal for you not to be able to touch your toes. We can get you better, and to your point, meet you where you are so that you can get better. So I think that's part of what we have to do as professionals. Don't come to me at a conference and say, well, how can I make this easier because they can't pass? No, it's okay if they fail.
Right. We know how to help you. We know where to help you. Testing, we use it in every other aspect. And I think that, as I've always said, whether it's an SFMA or FMS, nobody who's on the other end of my testing, screening, assessment, whatever, knows how bad they just did. They know the problem that it told me I need to start with. And that's all we need to talk about. If you need me to tell you all the imperfections I saw in you, it's going to look like the Dead Sea Scrolls, and so's mine. My point is, that's not where I'm starting. It's overwhelming to you, and it's unnecessary, because if I get the weakest link, many of these aggregate problems seem to evaporate on the path to getting that back. And so, you know, the reason for doing any of the metrics that we've contributed to are simply to find the weakest link and then figure out what's the most holistic and responsible way to get your awareness, protection, correction, and ultimately your balance back where you lost it. But yeah, if we don't figure out easier, cleaner ways to talk about this. And I think one of the ways we did it is that quick test retest, where we've got a simple little balance signature or a toe touch, and you came in and you couldn't do it, and we did some of our movement stuff, and then you could do it. And the most important thing is we didn't practice the test. We went somewhere below that, deep into your movement engine. We woke something up, we did something, and came back out. Kyle, the only thing I want you to help us finish up with is your work is actually taking you to something we touched on, which is how do you jumpstart the local when you're ready with the developmental sequence and the holistic assessment and the SFMA and the YBT are there letting you know your marks are good and they're still going slow. Because if they're going too slow, we're going to wind up with a surgery we don't need and an opioid that ain't going to help. So give us a solution for the person who is really at a loss of where to go.
Yeah, I'll be happy to share that. It's a journey I've been on for about 11 or 12 years. I've been consulting with a medical device startup company Mainstay Medical. And the idea was, because this inhibition is so great and there's such a large percent of the population out there that have chronic back pain that have failed all the things we're talking about. Unfortunately, you look through the algorithm and they're like, there's nothing left. They've failed rehab. They've failed medicine. They failed injections. If they knock on one more door, someone will operate on them. That's not what they need. It's a large percent of people. And the idea is we bypass all the inhibition, all the noise above that deep multifidus muscle, the kind of the window into the core. And it's an implantable stimulator that actually gives electric stimulation to the nerve going right into the muscle. So it's a big deal. It's a, we call an active implantable. It's a small procedure where you have the electrodes placed right next to the nerve and there's a battery that gets programmed. You lie on your back, and because you couldn't do your exercises on your own because of the inhibition, the machine, if you will, does it for you. So the research on it's strong. It works well for chronic back pain if we pick the right patients, like anything. But I think the key is that we're bypassing all the inhibition that's really the main problem at that point. The nerve gets stimulated, it gets the muscle to contract, and the brain feels this nice, authentic contraction. So when I say I've gone around the world literally and training physicians about muscles and back pain, this has been that opportunity that we're just starting to get this device out across the U.S. So it's been exciting for me and fun. And unfortunately, it's only for patients with failed rehabilitation. And I'm a rehabilitationist, so it's a challenge. But I've trained a lot of physios and spent a lot of time, and they're all pretty excited because, you know, if you are a physio or a chiropractor and you look in the mirror, you know there's some back pain patients under your watch that didn't get better. It's just that's how hard it is. Not your fault. That's just the reality.
Does the implantable device ever come back out?
It can. Yeah, it's not designed to, but it can. What we saw in the trials, again, there's probably been about 1,000 of them done in the U.S. at this point. Several studies. Won't dig into the weeds on that, but. In younger patients, after about a year and a half to 2 years, so we really asked them, say, hey, use this thing for a year every day, and the compliance was quite high in the 90% of people that used it as described. But a year and a half, 2 years, they start using it less. Say you get it 2 years, they're using it once a month, they're not using it at all. There were some younger people that said, listen, I feel great, my back pain's gone, I want this thing taken out, and there were several that were removed for success, which is not necessarily the goal. I mean, you know, you went through all this active, you went through this whole process to get the device placed. That's not something we look for. But in younger people, we've taken some out, yeah.
No, well, I wanted to say that because I do think that is such a more responsible alternative than altering structure or numbing you up. I think it is now, having said that, failed rehab, done right, deserves this option. Failed rehab, incomplete, does not. And we started this conversation talking about recognizing this low back pain as both global behaviors and local behaviors. And if the measurables of your global behaviors or local behaviors are below the cut, we got to deal with that. And I honestly think we would have far less people getting so far into low back pain and needing what you're talking about if they hadn't had to spend 5 more years reinforcing that inhibition and that compensation. So, you know, taking your global measures and making that basket of objectivity just as heavy as the basket of local and just as heavy as the basket of symptoms, you'll see clearly what's going on. And to me, the least reliable basket is the symptoms. If I give you a global and local exam and you check out great and you're screaming that your head's on fire, you're not my patient. I'm not saying you're not somebody's patient, but there's no physical explanation in my wheelhouse for what's going on here. And I do need to refer out. Otherwise, I'm going to find a local thing that shows me a global connection or a global thing that has a local connection, or there's nothing under there. You had a bad movement pattern and there's no mobility stability reason for it. This is a habit that we got to break. We see that too. But responsible rehab now has an out when we do have those fail cases that doesn't necessarily have to be a fusion or this whole pain management series that might not be necessary if we just do both ends of our job.
Yeah, you know, it is comprehensive rehabilitation, and what does that mean? And so it is an opportunity to create more awareness around what that is for physicians and rehab providers that haven't thought about it at the level that we're talking about it. You know, the back pain model still kind of go into the back, and they deal with the back pretty much, even in rehabilitation. So it is a nice opportunity to open that up, to look at this more comprehensive view. And then in those folks that trickle down and it just doesn't work for, we have another alternative. As you said, it's non-pharmaceutical, and it's not a biomechanical changing surgical procedure. It's literally an active implant, small little lead and a battery. So pretty safe, and we're not changing the structure, if you will, but we are showing that we're changing the function with it in those chronic patients.
Nice job. By the way, shameless plug here. You did a low back pain course, didn't you?
Low back pain course. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, shameless plug. Yeah. Guess where you can find it.
No. Well, tell me this. What's a clinician who's either using our model or not using our model going to learn from that? Because basically if I ask you to come and do an international conference on low back pain right now, and I could attend it live, you'd be doing something off this scaffolding, I would imagine. Correct?
Yeah, for sure. You know, what you're going to get is a little touch of each of the models that have been proven to work, right?
Okay.
So it's a very simple thing, but in back pain, in a lot of areas, we get sort of stuck in one way. I'm going to do my rehab my way. And that works for the percent of patients that walk in your door that need that rehab, and it doesn't work for the percent that don't, right? So you can use the pie analogy, the bucket analogy, whatever it is, but we're going to teach you how to get patients into the right bucket for that initial hands-on, meet them where they are, 6 or 7 out of 10 pain. They're not ready for a bunch of movement. How do you manage that first, right? And then as it trickles down and the pain's better, we've got them under control, guess what? Well, then we're going right into all the movement pieces, and we're going to rebuild that core from a neurodevelopmental perspective and cover those global tests at the end. So the farther away from that first day that you go, it's hard telling, you know, what kind of diagnosis you had. But if you walk in day one, day two, day three, I can tell you there's about four separate, very distinct paths that you need to take as a rehabilitation provider to optimize your opportunity for a good outcome at the other end.
All right. Well, I want to sum this up and first of all tell you, I think our relationship started with me teaching you a few things, but you've definitely taught me an equal amount. And the day you told me it was time for you to go on your path and you're going to leave the clinic and you thought there were going to be hard feelings, I'm like, no, I'm very anxious to see what you're getting ready to do with this thing. So I want to say that. And I also want to say that I think the reason that low back pain is such a problem and is such a big topic, is because we've been taught to live with it and be a little more comfortable. If we worked in countries where we all had to get up and work every day, we would have figured this out. I hate to say this personally. If I had to be a manual laborer, I probably wouldn't have lived with as much pain as I've had to live with. But you can comfortably do it if you can call your shots and you live in a comfortable environment. So the fact that low back pain is now part of our culture and we're used to living with it, and just take some more ibuprofen, just lay out of work, whatever, you know, just get through the episode. Those compounding episodes leave a mark on you. And so a lot of times when we've get somebody in Western culture with low back pain, there's a lot to unravel. Whereas if we're working with somebody who uses their body every day and they get pinged, we probably can trace it back to the activity of the episode. We can no longer do that. So we've been taught to live with low back pain as part of our culture. And I honestly think that unraveling that and finding each bucket where somebody belongs is the quickest way to get them back to a culture that doesn't have to wake up and think about working around your pain today.
Yeah, very, very well put. And yeah, thanks for your mentorship, obviously, Gray, and more important, both of your friendship. And we're going to keep chipping away, you know, getting a few years on all of us, but we're not ready to check in quite yet. So we're going to keep pushing this agenda, if you will. And I'm excited to see where it takes us from here. So,
well, I hope we arrive, because before you logged on, Lee was talking about getting a new jet ski, and I want to make sure he can afford that. So,
so do I. Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, guys.
That will do it for this episode of the Movement Podcast.
Thanks for listening. And if you liked what you heard, please take a minute and subscribe and review.
If you want to learn more about our system and take the next step in your own movement journey,
visit us at movementpod.com.
Until next time, be sure to first move well,
then move often.